This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. Now, I've traveled across half our state to be here and to see about this land. I'm a family man. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview. I have many wells flowing at many thousand barrels per day. I can guarantee to start drilling and to put up the cash to back my word.
That's Daniel Day-Lewis as an oil man during the early days of the oil industry in the movie There Will Be Blood. A few months ago, Terry spoke with the film's writer and director, Paul Thomas Anderson. Anderson also made Boogie Nights, Hard Eight, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love. He was nominated for 3 Academy Awards this year for writing, directing, and producing There Will Be Blood, which will be released on DVD early next month. The movie is loosely based on the 1927 novel Oil by Upton Sinclair. Daniel Day-Lewis plays a silver prospector who discovers oil, then buys the drilling rights to oil-rich land in rural California by promising poor families he can transform their lives through the money oil will bring. But in one town, he meets a boy preacher and faith healer named Eli Sunday, who also is promising the townspeople he can transform their lives through his direct connections to the Holy Spirit. In this scene, the oil man, Daniel Plainview, is trying to convince the boy preacher and his father to let Plainview drill for oil on their land. The preacher is played by Paul Dano, who co-starred in Little Miss Sunshine as the Silent Brother.
My offer to you is $3,700.
What is it that brought you here, sir?
The good Lord's guidance. Now, of course, within that, we're going to develop a lease. What's that?
What about our oil?
What about it?
We have oil here. That's worth something.
Oh, do you have someone who can drill for it? Do you think there's oil here?
I know there is.
Oh, it's very expensive to drill. You know, to get it up and out of the ground. You ever tried that before?
How much is it?
Costly.
Well, our oil sits right up on top of the ground.
I believe that's called seepage. Doesn't necessarily mean there's anything underneath.
What would you give us for it?
I don't know.
Something you don't know.
That's right. What would you like, Eli?
$10,000.
For what?
For my church.
That's good. That's a good one. Well, if we decide to drill for oil, and if the well begins to produce, I'll give your church a $5,000 signing.
$10,000.
Do you want to find someone else that's going to come up here and drill, Eli? Make the investment and do all the hard work that goes into it?
A little later on, we'll hear Terry's interview with Paul Dano, who plays the preacher. But first, let's listen to her 2007 interview with the writer and director of There Will Be Blood, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Paul Thomas Anderson, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the movie. You know, an interesting thing about There Will Be Blood is that there's no real pleasure in the movie. I don't mean in watching the movie, but I mean the characters in the movie have no pleasure. There's very little eating in the movie. There's no sex. There's no entertainment. And even the oil man, who becomes quite wealthy, doesn't seem to be interested in much that money can buy. He's interested in finding oil. That's his obsession. That's all he really seems to care about.
You know, it says something about the men of this period that were kind of on the tail end of the wild, wild west, who started as silver miners and kind of got into the oil business because that's what was happening. You know, that was what was in front of them. They could never really shake that ambition and that drive to work, that what they enjoyed the most was the fever, the insanity, just the process, that actually getting the stuff or the riches from it somehow was really unsatisfying to them. I that's my guess, because so many of them had this incredibly hard time transitioning into the 20th century. You know, they'd have these palatial mansions, but they'd still live like they were living in a tent, you know. So whatever they were after, once they got it, clearly wasn't satisfying their hunger, that they liked being hungry, that they probably preferred being hungry.
The way your movie is, it revolves around two people's stories. One of them is the independent oil man who becomes a millionaire through acquiring all this oil property. And then this boy preacher who's a fundamentalist preacher and claims to be able to get rid of the devil, no matter where the devil is, in the room or in your body. And they're both great salesmen. They both have their pitches down. And they're both completely the opposite of each other in terms of what it is that they're pitching. And I guess what interested you in this dichotomy between the oil man and the boy preacher?
First and foremost, it's a great boxing match.
Yeah.
You know, they start out with their wits and their words, and then they start throwing punches. But just that idea of a boxing match, you know, was so terrific. It's funny because I'd originally thought it would be a good idea. It turned out it was not a good idea, but I had imagined the boy preacher is like 12 or 13 years old, you know, that no matter what Plainview, no matter what age somebody he was faced with, if somebody had his own same line of BS, you know, they were going to be a formidable opponent. We thought better of it. You know, we thought that would be a little bit absurd to have a 12 or 13-year-old boy, but the ideas remain the same, just to get them in the ring together.
There Will Be Blood is set in the late 19th and early 20th century, but the two kind of themes, two of the themes of the movie are so contemporary, you know, corporate obsession and power and religious obsession and power, still two of the driving forces in our country and our culture. I guess you were thinking about that a lot when you made the film.
Yeah, of course, but best to approach it like I said, like a boxing match or like a horror story, you know, rather than kind of this sort of the endless kind of punctuation that you could put on that kind of stuff that's there already. You know, you've got an oil man, you've got a preacher. Let the rest just be a fight to the death.
You had to learn so much to recreate the period, and you had to learn a lot about the early days of oil exploration. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, like in the early part of the film, when the Daniel Day-Lewis character is first learning how to dig for oil, I mean, the technology is basically like a bucket on a pulley that he pulls up by hand, and then he deposits the oil on a big puddle by the well.
Yeah, that's it.
And then things kind of grow a little from there. Go ahead.
Not all that stuff just comes from the written descriptions of how Edward Doheny first found oil right near Dodger Stadium near downtown L.A. They talk about starting out. Usually, they were essentially using what they knew as silver miners, which is you dig a hole. And then they realized they were down about, you know, 50, 60 feet, and that they were choking on the fumes. So they said, well, we can't be down here to get this stuff up out of here. How are we going to do it? And they built an A-frame, you know, with a 50-foot eucalyptus tree that they'd shaved down and were just trying to drive it into the ground. I mean, these really primitive techniques. And the funny thing is, as much as it's changed, it's still kind of the same as it is today. It's just driving an enormous pole into the ground over and over and over again until, you know, you poke the monster enough and it erupts. But yeah, we just kind of we were recreating things that had been written down by people that were there, you know, saying we found the oil and we scooped it up with whatever we had, bottles and cans and saucepans, whatever it was. Just that fever to get it up and out of the ground. They didn't even really have a place to put it, so they were just digging holes.
There are some really horrifying accidents that happen during the course of the movie while people are digging for oil. Did you study up on what typical accidents were like in those early oil days?
Yeah, we read about a few, you know, and then they're all so graphic. I mean, there were a few written about in Upton Sinclair's book and then a few just from various other sources that we had. But then when we built the derrick and we got out there and we had this terrific guy named Jim Farmer, who's an old oil man who came out to help us out with some of the details of the drilling. And boy, once we met him, I mean, the stories just came fast and furious, you know. I mean, to the point where you just had kind of had enough. You're like, I don't need to hear about one more accident, you know. But quite honestly, you were aware of the dangers every single second, particularly when you've got a film crew around, you know, just everything was dangerous. The danger that something was going to fall, the danger that your fingers were going to get caught somewhere. I mean, it's horribly dangerous labor, and particularly out there where I think at the time these oil guys worked in 12-hour shifts. So for 12 hours they would work, and then they'd go to wherever the bar was and drink for 10 hours, sleep for 2 hours, probably stop at church on the way in, and then do it all over again, you know. So not only is there the danger just in general, but you factor in booze and heat and all the rest, and it's just, it's amazing.
So is one of the accidents in the movie based on a story that you were told about a real accident or something that you read?
The bit falling, there's a character named Joe Gunda who we meet very briefly. The bits fall, and he's down in a cellar, which is a place where they sort of collect the mud. That was from the Upton Sinclair book where I first read it. And then talking to some of our old-timers and oil guys, they would just tell us endless stories about bits falling, guys drowning in the mud. And maybe they'd get hit in the head by something that fell, and that wouldn't be what killed them. But, you know, drowning in this mud would be the thing that got them. Not to mention the work that they were doing, you know, high up. These derricks are 80 feet tall. So, you know, from time to time people would fall. And then, I mean, and we're not even factoring in what happens when these things do come in. Ideally for them, they knew when they were coming in. They knew they'd sort of hit a certain sand that they were looking at and smelling and saying, okay, we're very close. And they could prepare, however they did prepare, for the gusher to come in. But those times when a gusher would come in, they didn't know it. I mean, you were in trouble. You were in a lot of trouble, particularly if it lit on fire, and anything could light it on fire. Just a rock shooting up out of the ground could be a spark that could catch a flame.
And that happens in the movie, and there's this huge fire that erupts after the gusher starts gushing. And I'm thinking about how challenging that scene must have been to create. First of all, I don't know if an oil fire burns differently than, say, a wood fire or any other fire, and if you had to make sure that you were creating an oil fire so that the fire would look authentic.
Yeah, well, black smoke is the key. You know, oil burns black, and we were using diesel fuel, and it burned pretty darn close to how real crude oil would burn. And we augmented it a little bit with some digital effects, just helping to kind of darken it a little bit, but it sure felt like the real thing when we did it. And, you know, we had a special effects guy, a terrific guy named Steve Kremens, and whose job it was to get thousands of gallons of diesel fuel spouting up in the air and then to light it on fire. And he said to us, you know, I cannot guarantee that I can put this fire out. I can do it and I can turn it off. But once that derrick catches on fire, there's a chance I might not be able to put it out. We thought he was just playing it safe, you know, that would be... But the second we lit the match, it was clear there was no way we were going to be able to put it out because the wood was so dry. It was so much gasoline. And we were essentially forced to do that entire sequence within two takes in about 45 minutes before the derrick tumbled to the ground.
Yeah, and the fire is alive. I mean, so you're shooting something that has a life of its own.
Yeah. It doesn't take direction very well.
Right.
But that's what's fun about it, too. You know, it's great. I mean, we were so nervous leading up to lighting that fire because, first of all, we were in love with our derrick. You know, we're so proud of it. And we knew we were going to be completely melancholy when it was gone. Mixed in with that, we were all completely petrified at the prospect of screwing it up. I mean, what are you going to do? We're not going to build it again. That wasn't going to happen, you know. And obviously, we were pretty careful. We weren't going to do it if the wind was blowing too much. To be really honest with you, it was kind of one of the benefits of shooting out in West Texas because they're a lot looser out there. You know, I don't think we could have done anything like that in California. They would have had a heart attack out there.